cuts. Cuts in front and scores. What a play by Ryan Callahan.
Scott Gomez gets his first goal as a Sharp.
And the Blackhawks' aggregate record is now 20-0-3.
I didn't think we played hard enough. I didn't think we did the necessary things that we needed to do to win the game.
The big plays, the big stories, the biggest news from across the hockey landscape. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290.
TSN1290.ca.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba, and for all those joining us live at TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A little later than normal on this Wednesday evening, but we still have two great hours of hockey talk in store for you. Coming up in mere minutes, the president of hockey operations and general manager of the Nashville Predators, David Poile, is going to join us, talk about the Nashville Predators being the GM of that team. He's going to join us coming up in a couple of minutes. Later on in the program, Jeremy Rutherford from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is going to join us to talk about the St. Louis Blues. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, first of all, good evening. Richard Pollock, Ezra Ginsberg. I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Before, let's get started with the Patrick Kaleta hit on Brad Richards. We'll talk about this ahead of David Poile calling in to join this program. Patrick Kaleta hits Brad Richards on the New York Rangers, gets a 5-game suspension. It's a crystal clear hit from behind, a very dangerous hit where the guy goes head first, where he can't brace himself right into the boards. 5 games enough for that hit, or Kaleta, given his history and, how do I put this charitably, his goonish actions,
Did he deserve more, Drew? Probably, but I mean, this is the NHL and Brendan Shanahan, and Shanahan has kind of moved off of the heavy-handed suspension since he began his tenure as disciplinarian. So, 5 is, based on this, what they've been giving out so far, is probably about right. If you're looking for more discipline, though, it seems like the pressure from managers and owners around the league has taken down any big suspensions, you know, of the 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-game variety. But Kaleta, overall, that's his reputation precedes him. It was a cheap play. It was lower back. He knew what was happening. And we talk a lot about concussions, but the hits from behind are almost an epidemic as well, and they certainly provided a risk of not only concussions but broken necks and other things. So Kaleta, his value is in drawing penalties and being kind of a troublemaker, but it's a lack of respect, and I do agree with John Tortorella that needs to be outlawed from the game.
Yeah, this is probably going to be the one time, possibly in my life, that I agree with John Tortorella. No, I'm just kidding.
Ezzy, are you ready for the rematch? You know it's coming up on Thursday night.
I'm ready to
Ezzy versus Tortorella, round two.
Absolutely. No, but they got it right here. And, you know, Richie mentioned that he could have got more games. When you look at the footage, and, you know, anybody who's a hockey fan has watched this footage probably, you know, 50 times by now. And when we live in this age of social media, you can get it wherever you really please, on your iPhone, whatever. But, you know, if you look at the hit, he really doesn't really push him that hard. Coletta's a strong guy. Richards isn't a small guy, but he's not a big guy. And You listen to Aaron Ward talk about it, and he talks about numbers, and he sees the numbers, meaning the number on the back of his jersey. And he's in the most vulnerable position you can be in is when you can't see the guy behind you, because then you really have absolutely no opportunity to brace yourself for the hit. So 5 games, yeah, I think it is fair. You know, he's going to forfeit, I believe, just over $76,000. It's his third suspension, and I think he feels bad about it. And, you know, he probably would have felt bad about it if it was, you know, a player that wasn't of Brad Richards' stature, but it probably, you know, makes him think a little bit more because it was a player of Brad Richards' stature. So I think a message was sent. And, you know, I talked about last week on this show, you know, how Shanny got it right with Max Pacioretty and Ryan McDonough. And I think this is a perfect example of when a guy was responsible and was totally vulnerable and didn't turn into the hit. So I think, you know, this is a good suspension for the NHL.
Plus, from the other side of the boardroom door, this is Inside the Front Office.
Inside the Front Office for this Wednesday evening features the general manager and president of hockey operations of the Nashville Predators, David Poile. Mr. Poile, good evening, and thank you for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Good evening. How are you guys doing?
We're doing very well. Thank you very much. Earlier this week, the waivers wire process is sort of a different process in that it's not a straight trade like you would see between two franchises. And earlier this week, your organization put in two waiver claims for Zach Boychuk and Bobby Butler. Can you maybe explain to our listeners how the waiver system works and how you go about putting in a claim for a player and how you find out if you do indeed get that player?
Well, we have the order for doing that is exactly like the standings in the NHL. So the worst team in the league right now has the first pick. The best team in the league would have the 30th pick. So if there was multiple claims on those players, it would go in that order. I don't know exactly where we are in the standings with 30 teams. We're probably between 10 and 15, around 15 probably. Nobody else took them before us. I have no idea whether anybody took them after us. That's not made common knowledge, so that's how the process works. What you do, waivers is a 24-hour period now in new collective bargaining agreement. So waivers happen at noon each day, Eastern Standard Time. It's a 24-hour period, as I said, and you have to put in your claim anytime between that and 24 hours. We have a system on both in email and faxes to the NHL, and yeah, you do that, and then they let you know at 11, 12 o'clock Eastern Time whether you got the player or not.
Aside from obviously having to pay the player's salary, is there any other fee involved with acquiring a player off waivers?
Yeah, there's a waiver fee, and it's all based on years pro. It's higher for the youngest players, and it's a nominal amount of money for the most veteran players. So, for claiming these players, it was around $50,000 approximately.
Mr. Poile, it seems that there's a trend in the NHL that, has seen certain teams not want to spend, the big money or the long-term deal on goaltenders. Was there one particular thing about Pekka Rinne that convinced you that he was worth the significant contract that you gave him?
Well, it's probably not one significant thing. It's probably the combination of a whole bunch of things all were very positive. I mean, I look at the Pekka both from a draft standpoint and a development standpoint is, if you could, write something out as to how you'd like to develop players and bring them along within your system, that would be the perfect situation. The late round draft pick brought from Finland over to Milwaukee, played 3 years in Milwaukee to adapt to the professional hockey and to get his level of play and confidence up, and brought up to the NHL as a backup goaltender and then eventually as a number one goaltender. And I mean, I think it's always a body of work when you make a decision on anybody, especially on a long-term contract for a lot of money like we paid Pekka. And, Shea Weber, I mean, they're elite players. And, I think you could argue that, Pekka's, one of the, the three or four best goaltenders in the league. Everybody probably has their own opinion. I think it's been supported, if you will, by some of the experts in the league, and the fact that he's been a finalist, for the for the Vezina Trophy 2 years in a row, and also has had MVP votes in the NHL for the last couple of years. So you're never 100% right on all these decisions, but feel good about that decision.
David, some will say that, the most important job for a general manager is player evaluation, talent evaluation more specifically. From your perspective, when you're evaluating players that may become available, whether on your team, pending free agents, or on other teams, how do you, one of the questions I always wonder is when certain players always play together, so they're paired together in all situations, whether at even strength or on the penalty kill or even on the power play, how are you able to discern which one will succeed away from the other?
Well, that's a good question, and again, sometimes the two players together, if it's a defense pairing or a forward line, they have that chemistry, and when you break them up, they're never the same. I mean, it's somewhat unexplainable, but I mean that's what we're always looking for. You're looking for those combinations. I mean, sometimes for a line, it's just two guys. It doesn't have to be three guys, or for a defense pairing, it's just able to read off of each other. I mean, which stands out in my mind is when you talk about the Sedins. Well, that's that's the most unusual situation, that they're brothers, they're twins. I mean, I guess genetically, instinctively, they do know what each other is doing all the time. But we all know when we watch them play, I mean, it's like they just throw in the puck, it seems blindly, and bang, it's right on the other guy's stick. And I mean, you don't see that too often, but we're looking for that all the time. And you know, I wish I could tell you there's exactly a key to it, because we go through, you know, lots of defense pairings and lots of line combinations, you know, during the course of the season, just to try to find, you know, that chemistry. And the coaches are always talking about that, is like, who plays, you know, the best together? How can you generate some offense? Which two or three guys can play together? So it's I think it's an ongoing process with all the players. And if you get that one line, or that those combinations of pairings, I mean, they're going to stick together for a long time.
You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290. We're joined by the Nashville Predators general manager, David Poile. Now, David, as a general manager, you've had occasion to trade draft picks for a player whose contract is expiring only a few months after acquiring them. You know, under the current CBA, you know, is there any sort of window of opportunity given to you as a team acquiring a player in which you can try and discuss a contract extension with the player you're acquiring?
Not really. I mean, you know, I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about, but let's say we get to the trading deadline. Like last year, the trading deadline, I traded for two players in Hal Gill and Paul Gostad, one from Montreal, one from Buffalo, who were both going to be unrestricted free agents at the end of the season. When I traded for them, they're basically last deals. They're just before the trading deadline. And in those situations, club certainly is not going to give you permission to talk to the player or his agent about the future. It was our hope, and it turned into reality, is that we were able to re-sign them both. Mm-hmm. And obviously that makes the trade, you know, seem to be fair, if you will, because you tend to overpay at a trading deadline. So it's a, you know, it's somewhat of a disadvantage for sure. I mean, if those players come to your team, you don't have any success, or they don't like your team or your situation, then they certainly can move on to another team, and you know, you've given up what you've given up. And I've been in those situations before. If you made the playoffs or had a good playoff run, it's worth it. If you don't, you wonder why you did it. So it's those are tough situations.
Along those same lines, do you ever, as a general manager, do you feel added pressure to re-sign those players you acquire under a, you know, on a so-called rental basis, knowing that you've given up the valuable draft picks?
Well, you hope that you made the right decision in acquiring those players, and you hope that they want to re-sign with you because they're good players. I mean, if it goes both ways, I mean, if you've made the deal and you get the player and he's not all that you thought he was supposed to be, then you know, sometimes you're better off that they don't have a contract going forward, and you know, you just cut your losses at the draft choices or whatever you gave up for that player. So it can work you know, both ways. So that's why the trading deadline is a really interesting time. The prices usually are inflated at that time, and you know, you can look back and you can be quite a critique on what were the good deals and what deals didn't work out so good. And there's plenty of good deals, and believe me, there's plenty of deals that don't seem to make sense after the fact.
David, I heard an interesting interview, you know, recently with Bruce Boudreau, and he was asked about the pending free agency of Ryan Getzlaff and Corey Perry, and he said, you know, being in Anaheim, it really hasn't been the distraction. It'd be somewhere else. When you're talking to prospective free agents, do you ever pitch the idea that you can play for a great professional organization but not have that added media attention and pressure that comes along with playing in the NHL in bigger markets such as New York or Toronto?
Well, I think when you're talking about your own specific franchise, every city, every franchise has something unique and special, and there's lots of good places to play in the National Hockey League. You know, for the player, I mean, you know, his number one concern is usually where does he fit in terms of what's his role, is his ice time, how has he been able to contribute. And I mean, money certainly ranks right up there as one of the first or second considerations. And then you get into all the intangibles. I mean, you know, he married, single. I mean, is he from a small town? Does he want to play in a smaller market, say like Nashville, or is he looking for the big lights on Broadway, like in New York City? And you know, a lot of times players have strong preferences for that. So we sell Nashville for what it is. It's a great place to live. There hasn't been one player that's ever played here in 15 years that didn't like it, didn't ask to be out. Our coaching staff is great. You know, I think Nashville now that we've been in this league this long, stands on its own, and I don't think free agents have any problem coming here. But I think the size of our city and where we're located, you know, the music, all that stuff, I think is a great attraction for free agents.
You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL Midweek. We're joined by Nashville Predators General Manager David Poile.
Mr. Poile, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about Barry Trotz, you know, being a good boy from Dauphin, Manitoba. As you know, we're located here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. What is the key to the stability of the Predators organization with you and Barry Trotz having been together for so long?
Well, Barry's been phenomenal. I've told the story many, many times. When I got the job back in 98, before we started, I asked a lot of my peers about who would run expansion teams, you know, what they thought I should do. And every one of them said the exact same thing. He said, your team is not going to be any good, and you've got to hire the most experienced coach because he'll, you know, he'll help cover up a lot of the mistakes of your team. And I took that advice, and I thought about it and thought about it, and I said, you know what? I said, somebody gave me a chance once, and expansion teams, I agree, aren't that good, and it's sort of a process. I said, I'd like to get all, you know, give a lot of people chances, whether they be, you know, scouts or front office people or coaches. And Barry had worked with me in the minors, and I knew that he was very good and an up-and-coming coach, and I really felt it was the right thing to do. And, you know, talk about decisions that, you know, you think are some of your best decisions you've ever made. That has to be right at the top of hiring Barry Trotz. He's been a great coach, and he's been a wonderful person to work with. He's been fabulous in our community, and I can't say enough good things about Barry.
David, has, you know, everybody has now cell phones and then the proliferation of all technology. Has that taken over as a GM as well? Are you more often in touch with other general managers than you were in the past because of communication being so readily available?
Absolutely. It's you know, we're all affected by it. I mean, whether it's, you know, Twitter, it's, you know, you're getting updates during the game on other games from, whether it be your own people, you know, through texting or what have you, whether it be through media, it's there. It's 24/7. I mean, we always kid about the old days when we didn't have cell phones. And if I was on the road, there'd be no way to ever get hold of you. So you'd go back to your hotel room, you'd open up the door, and, you know, you'd be just, your heart would be pounding whether, you know, is the red light flashing in the room or not. Well, now we don't even, nobody knows where you stay. You don't even get out your hotel number because everybody's got your cell phone. No, it's 24/7, and yeah, we're available all the time and in contact all the time, and the news and moves real fast in this business, as you guys know.
Mr. Poile, we'll let you go on this last question. You know, we've spoken sort of about the consistency in the Predators organization. That also applies to your assistant general manager, Paul Fenton. He's been with you for a number of years. You know, as you two have worked together over the years, have you guys sort of changed your responsibilities and your day-to-day activities, or is it sort of pretty much status quo from when you guys began your relationship together?
Well, I think it's grown every year, and Paul has taken on more and more responsibility, and I'm really grooming Paul to be a general manager, and I think he's ready for that. I think there's been, you know, some situations where he probably certainly deserves to at least have an interview for a job. So I'm his biggest supporter, and again, any decisions that we're making, anything we're doing, I'm doing it in concert with Paul. He's a terrific hockey guy, a great evaluator, and he's my right hand man.
David Poile, the general manager of the Nashville Predators, we appreciate you giving us your time. Thank you very much for joining us this evening on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Okay, guys, thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to break. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. A big thank you to David Poile, the general manager of the Nashville Predators, for having joined us. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on our website, illegalcurve.com. It'll also be available on tsn1290.ca. We've now had David Poile, and years ago, we had Paul Fenton on our program, if you recall.
Former Winnipeg Jet Paul Fenton.
Of course, former Winnipeg Jet.
32? 22? What number did he
win? 11.
I thought 11 also.
Okay, so
yeah.
I wasn't even close.
Well, no, but you had the, you know, they're all multiples of 11 that you mentioned
that's
there.
That's true, yeah.
But Paul Fenton, you got to figure, is a guy, as David Poile said, is a guy who's probably very, and then if not this year, then next year, is right up at the top of the list, the guy who's going to get his chance as a general manager.
Yeah, overdue, in my opinion, overdue. Should have been considered. I don't know if he was considered here. I know Chevy was kind of the locked-in guy, but Paul Fenton, very experienced. And you work with David Poile, and you work in the market, you know. You work in the market and the place that it's not an easy place to manage, and they've made it really a destination for hockey players. I mean, remember that, and David just talked about it, you know, there's trades that you like, you don't like, but bringing in the Forsberg and the Korea and those group and then doing it a different way and making runs sometimes and not, but he's very, very polished and drafting well for the most part, not as well lately as they did earlier on, but as David just mentioned, Paul Fenton's being groomed by him. And I really like that part of the interview, I thought, because he's being honest. You know, he believes Paul Fenton is the quality, and that's also something to take into account. He believes he's of the quality to be a future successful general manager, and I think that in the next out of the next 5 to 6, 7 spots that come up, I would assume that Paul Fenton would be one of those hirings.
You know, it's hard to believe, but the Nashville Predators are the only team in the last 2 years to make it to the second round 2 years in a row. I mean, if you look at the parity in the NHL and what we have in nowadays, which basically everyone has a shot up until, you know, a week left in the season to make the playoffs. Really, a couple teams are out of it, but you know, Richie mentioned the guys that have come there. You look like a guy like Mike Fisher who's gone there and he's really, you know, taken a love to Nashville. But year after year, you know, when Suter went to Minnesota, everyone said, okay, this is going to be the year. But look at Nashville right now, you know, fighting tooth and nail. You know, they're struggling a little bit here, but they're fighting tooth and nail for a playoff spot again. And when you have that structure and that organizational stability in place, Richie, I mean, it's really tough to have that big of a drop-off. I mean, Nashville isn't quite bright as far as the longevity, but you look at up there with the, you know, the way organizations are run, Nashville's up there with Detroit to be in the class of the NHL.
We talk about Winnipeg. I mean, Winnipeg has apparently tailored themselves after the Nashville organization.
Can't quite see it yet, but hopefully in time.
Six things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. Six
things we learned this week. We'll start with you, Richard Pollock. If the St. Louis Blues are to make a run, they need to add another top four NHL defenseman, and we'll talk to Jeremy Rutherford of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the second hour about the Blues.
Now, I didn't know he was going to be on when we formulated these thoughts. Three of the six, but no, that's what I think, and I'd be happy to ask Jeremy about that. The Blues are really strong on the right side of their back end, and with Pietrangelo and Kevin Shattenkirk, you know, both of those guys can really wheel, really skate well, move the puck really well, can do a lot of things. And then they have Roman Polak as the third right-handed shooting defenseman there, kind of, you know, not a great skater, but he's a big guy and he can hold down the fort on that third pairing. The problem is right now Shattenkirk's playing with Wade Redden. And you know, it's good to see Wade Redden back in the National Hockey League, but I just don't think that Wade Redden can do the trick and can fill that spot, or even Chris Russell, too. I don't think either of those guys can fill the spot against, for example, L.A. in the playoffs, Detroit in the playoffs, Chicago in the playoffs. And if St. Louis fancies themselves as being a top cup contending team, which I believe at forward and overall depth they probably can be, I think they need to make a move and solidify that top four.
Five.
Ezra Ginsberg, you want to talk about the Tampa Bay Lightning and their backup goaltending situation?
Matthew Garon hasn't been good this year, and if you've watched him the last few games, he was pulled and Lindback had to go in, and he's only won 2 out of 10 starts. And the Tampa Bay Lightning aren't getting good goaltending from Lindback right now either. His numbers are bad. And this is Lindback's first year as a undisputed number one goaltender. And I think the Tampa Bay Lightning, Stevie Yzerman, has put together the right pieces there that I think the Tampa Bay Lightning can... I think they're a playoff team. And I think if they get the right matchup, I think they can cause some trouble in the Eastern Conference playoffs this year. But Matthew Garon, I mean, he's done some good things with the Oilers in the past. But this year he's struggling, and it's not just the way Garon has played. I don't think it's just him getting replaced. I think they need a better backup goaltender, because I don't think Lindback is ready at 24 years old to play, you know, 80% of the games and take the Tampa Bay Lightning to the next level, you know, get back in the playoffs. So I think that's something that they have to address. Stevie Yzerman has too good of a team this year in a shortened season, too many offensive weapons, that he's going to have to pick up a better goaltender, because they're both struggling right now.
Four.
Richard Pollock, the Washington Capitals are a team that cannot find an identity, and that has as much to do with the talent on the ice as it does with three coaches in 2 years.
A lot of flack gets thrown at, you know, Bruce Boudreau, and was in this room as well. And Dale Hunter obviously did some nice things with the team, whether or not you like the style of play that he employed. Then you have Adam Oates. You know, the team isn't adjusting to the system. The team isn't this. I got to be honest. The team isn't that good. And talk about the system all you want. Talk about the new coaches all you want. The talent on the roster is not what it was a few years ago. Especially that back end and even the depth up front. You know, they don't really have an identity, but never mind the identity factor, because there are teams with skill that don't have the identity. I don't think the Capitals have the skill infusion and infused throughout their roster that they once did. And, you know, when they're coming to town and their back end third pairing is Tom Pody, who, with all due respect, has seen better days, and John Erskine, who I understand obviously know that they've signed to a contract extension, that doesn't inspire confidence. And you look at the other parts of their organization, and, you know, obviously Mike Green's injured a lot, but they just don't seem to have. You know, they haven't really ever locked down the shutdown NHL big-time defender. They haven't addressed that. And it seems like for years and years and years, they've had the same issues, and now I think that they're in a worse situation than before in terms of talent-wise, organizationally, but yet have the same issues, if not greater issues. It's if you're thinking Adam Oates is the savior there, to me, I think there's a bigger issue.
Ezzy, you think the New Jersey Devils may have stolen a player in Andre Loktionov, who they acquired from the Los Angeles Kings for only a fifth-round pick?
Fifth rounder. It's funny, you know. Again, just to preface this, I am a Devils fan at heart. Everybody that's listened to the show for 4 years knows that. But we were kind of joking around. Remus and I were joking around, at least when the Devils came into town. I looked at him. I said, "Hey, the Devils just acquired Loktionov. I bet he scores a goal." And what do you know? He scored a nice goal, actually. Against Andrei Pavlik. They got him for a fifth-rounder. It's funny, the connections. Andrei Loktionov's agent is Igor Larionov. Everyone knows Igor Larionov has a bit of a connection with the Devils, in addition to other teams, obviously. But they wanted out of L.A., and it tells you something when last year they wanted out of L.A., nobody wanted to pick him up. Okay, so you think, okay, maybe he's not that good, he's too small, and all that. This year the Devils listened to Larionov, went out and got him. He's got 5 points in 8 games. He's playing on the top line. Let's not crown him as the next Pavel Bure right now.
Yeah.
But the Devils, you know, don't have Zach Parise, so they're pretty desperate for scoring. He's been doing a pretty nice job. For a fifth-round pick, I think I'll take that every day of the week.
Two.
Back to Richard Pollock, staying with the New Jersey Devils. Peter DeBoer has not lost as much as some thought when Adam Oates and Larry Robinson departed as his assistant coaches this offseason.
Yeah, Adam Oates, previously mentioned, is well thought of offensively in terms of, you know, how he game plans. And, of course, Larry Robinson thought of as good of a defensive coach as there is, as good of a teacher as there's been in a long time in the National Hockey League. So DeBoer, having experience in Florida, but being a kind of a younger coach with Oates and Robinson, that was seen as a very strong coaching unit. But you really watch New Jersey closely, and they haven't really lost anything coaching-wise, as far as I can tell, in terms of the way they're playing. And I think DeBoer deserves a lot of credit. Lamoriello, who, you know, obviously, as he knows, will go through coaches like it's going out of style if he doesn't think they're doing the job, seems to have the utmost of confidence in DeBoer. And based on what I can see, there's every reason for him to have confidence in him. His team plays well. His team is hard. They play as a unit. And, you know, you hear that cliche a lot, but they really are able to play all parts working together. That's defense, that's forward, that's defensemen with the forwards, that's the wingers with each other. And there's a reason that the output is greater than the sum of the team's parts. You look at that roster and you look at their record overall. They've lost a lot. They don't have a great defense. And there's a lot of holes you could poke. They have older goalies. Think of all the holes. Yeah, think about the team that you're seeing out there on the nightly basis. And a lot of that credit goes to the coaches, especially Peter DeBoer.
Wrap six things with Ezzy on Shane Doan.
Shane Doan, I think, you know, he signed the 4-year deal, and, you know, there were rumblings that he was going to sign with another team. And when it was clear that he was going to be able to stay with Phoenix, he decided to sign that 4-year contract. But, you know, I just watched Shane Doan, and you watch the Phoenix Coyotes, and we know that they're well coached. Dave Tippett is a great coach, and he might be a Jack Adams candidate again this year with what he's doing with the team. But Shane Doan, to me, is going to go down as one of the greatest leaders in hockey after his career is over. You look at guys that come into that system, and it just seems to be a seamless transition, you know. And, you know, we mentioned, you know, during the lockout how influential he was with, you know, getting a deal done amongst other guys. Obviously, it was a big process. But, you know, Shane Doan, I think, as his career comes to an end, you're going to really truly appreciate what he's done. And some pretty bad Coyotes teams have made the playoffs the last couple of years. And Shane Doan's never been an 80-point guy, Richie. Mm-hmm. But Shane Doan has always been the type of guy, you know, he leads by example. And he does that not just by scoring. He lays body checks. He's a very smart guy. He might be, you know, top five most respected guys in the NHL. Just night in and night out. He hasn't missed a lot of games throughout his career. And I really respect him. And I think, you know, you're watching, when I watch him, I just watch a guy that, it's almost like a dying breed, like those guys like Steve Yzerman and those guys like Shane Doan. He learned by playing on those Olympic teams and those world championship teams. And I just really respect the guy. And I think you're seeing one of the best leaders to ever play the game, really.
I regret to inform our audience that Stompin' Tom has passed away.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Just announcement just came out over Twitter. There was a press release posted on his website. Stompin' Tom passed away at the age of 77, so there's only one song we could play going to commercial. Good for you, Stompin' Tom. All the best. TSN 1290. It's a good old hockey game. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. This segment is brought to you by our newest sponsor, Bernstein's Deli. We're thrilled to have Bernstein's Deli on board with us as a sponsor of both this program and of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You know Bernstein's Deli. They've been around in Winnipeg for over 20 years, located in the Cordon Village Mall. Pardon me, 25 years now. How time flies. We've spent a lot of time there over those 25 years.
It's like half your life.
Yes, exactly. They're located in the Cordon Village Mall at 1700 Cordon Avenue. You can rely on them for all of your catering needs. If you're looking for some Passover food, Passover catering to be done, Bernstein's Deli is your destination. And starting on March 17th, Sunday, March 17th, they're now going to be open on Sundays at 9 a.m. So you've enjoyed them Monday through Friday for all these years, Monday through Saturday for all these years, rather. Now, starting Sunday, March 17th, you can enjoy them on Sunday as well. Bernstein's Deli, visit them online at bernsteinsdeli.com or go check them out in the Cordon Village Mall.
We're pretty pumped to have them on board.
Absolutely. You know, Richie, we've been going there almost as long as it's been open.
Uh-huh.
Best borscht in town.
Oh, yeah.
Best latkes in town. Best corned beef in town. It's, you know, best food really in town. So check it out. Very pumped to have them on board. Hopefully we'll get some corned beef
you want samples, right?
Samples out of
you
this
want,
deal.
You want samples. I know what you want. Break it down. Break it down for this Wednesday evening. We'll focus on the Tampa Bay Lightning penalty kill.
Focus on a corned beef sandwich. That's you got the hot mustard at the top of the...
The Jets are going to face Tampa Bay tomorrow, obviously, where do they play?
I'm pretty sure to start talking about, you know, Jewish delicacies and delicatessens, Drew's mind goes completely back. Drew forgot that the Jets were playing Tampa in Tampa.
In Tampa. I'll be okay.
They're playing on a cruise ship in the Caribbean, Drew.
So that's hot mustard with a pickle on the side.
Tampa Bay penalty kill is currently 17th in the NHL at 81%. And when we looked at them on tape...
Sorry, that was funny. Okay.
When we looked at the Tampa Bay PK on tape, what we noticed first and foremost is how aggressive they are in the defensive zone. Now, that's... if I was ever, designing a penalty kill, I would also design a penalty kill that's very aggressive. That's sort of what I like... what I like to see out of a penalty kill. Now, what is it that the Lightning do that makes their penalty kill so aggressive?
Well, they literally go at the puck, and it's pretty rare to see a penalty kill this consistently aggressive. And what I mean by that is the forwards are extremely eager to get on top of the defenseman, you know, carrying the puck on the power play, you know, at the top of the blue line. And then the defensemen are just as aggressive, and they'll throw two at you at once. I mean, they don't really play by the rules. It's kind of run and gun penalty killing out there, and it's really interesting. And so what you'll see tomorrow in the game is the Jets will, you know, will get some power plays. And you'd hope after last night they may not, but they get some power plays. And what happens is, you know, Tampa's first unit, penalty killing wise, is if they have their way, is Nate Thompson, who is really their top penalty killer, and he is just crazy the way he hustles out there. So he's going to attack the top of the power play. What he's going to want to do, and a lot of teams do this, what he wants to do is push the puck down the boards, down the wall, as some people call it. So he doesn't want the puck, the Tampa doesn't want the puck on the blue line. They want the puck on the sides. This is especially troublesome if you're looking at it from a Jets perspective, because the Jets don't have players that excel on the hash marks. And what I mean by that is they don't have a St. Louis. They don't, you know, if you think back, they don't have a Dougie Waite. They don't have a kind of guy who can station himself on the half boards and make the passes. They lack really strong passing forwards. So Tampa will push the puck down, and that's Nate Thompson on one side and B.J. Crombie on the other. And the defense pairing, usually Hedman and Carl. So what you have there is a mobile unit of four. And then so they push you down the boards, and then they attack you, though. And they go quick. Like, they don't attack you like some teams and then stop and take away lanes. They just attack you and they go at you and they jump, and it's a pack mentality. And what happens is, if teams aren't quick with making decisions, they're on you before you know it and the puck's out.
Is it safe to describe it in some regards as a high risk, high reward penalty kill?
It is. It's very much like that. And you know, Drew, the other pairings that they have, especially the St. Louis Stamkos part. They have three penalty killing units in terms of forwards. St. Louis Stamkos is one. Certainly can create offense from that, especially those two guys. They can create offense from that, and they're dangerous that way. So you have to watch out for that too. But when they're so aggressive, Drew, what happens is, when you're so aggressive, by getting in a player's face, if the puck can move quicker than the pucks move faster than the players do, and if you can get them running around, which they do quite often, and you move the puck well, an efficient puck-moving team can make Tampa Bay's penalty kill look like a complete nightmare. And if I saw, you know, you watch the tape, you watch them, for example, against a team like Boston. Boston was just playing with them. That puck was going around the box, and boom, it was in the net. And boom, it was in the net again. Because Tampa was chasing. They were rotating their forwards at the top of the box, meaning, you know, the one forward was chasing the defenseman, the other forward was coming over, the defenseman were running around, and it was a little bit too chaotic, and Boston had this method of moving the puck around, and Tampa was chasing. And when you're chasing, what do? You go out of position, and then lanes open and opportunities appear.
It's funny. Last night, the Tampa Bay Lightning defeated the Devils.
Mm-hmm.
The Devils scored one power play. They only had two. I was watching because I knew we'd be talking about it. But it's funny how you mentioned the personnel they put out there, and specifically the defensemen. They put Matt Carl out there and Victor Hedman, too. More so offensive-minded defenseman, mm-hmm. especially Carl, who has become a power play specialist. Ask the Philadelphia Flyers how much they miss him mm-hmm. on their power play. But the Lightning actually have quite a few offensive defensemen. Even Sammy Sallow is a guy that has really specialized in the power mm-hmm. play. And, Richie, the guys that they put out there, it's funny. I think about John Madden and Jay Pandolfo. They were very aggressive. And John Madden got a lot of penalty-killing goals, shorthanded goals in his time. But you're right. I mean, the Jets, the Lightning, we should mention, if we didn't earlier, they're kind of middle of the pack, 17th in penalty killing. You know, not great, not bad. And what they decided to do, because their power play gets a lot of opportunities, and you have the St. Louis, the Stamkos, the Cavaliers out there, they've decided to make Nate Thompson and Crombie into their best penalty killers. And Crombie's more known as more of a fighter. And the guy that Thompson, by the way, had two goals last night versus the Devils. Thompson, you're right, he's very aggressive, and the best way to get around that, to go on more of on the offensive when you know a guy isn't going to be just a passive stick in the middle of the ice, is you try to move him around and work the puck down low. So you're right, it's a penalty kill that it's pretty good, but again, not the best in the league. And the Jets, if they're going to get going here, You know, it has to be against the Lightnings and the Panthers, not the better penalty-killing teams in the league, because you're not going to get that many opportunities. The Jets, I don't even know if they had a power play last night, did they?
I don't believe they did have a power play.
I don't recall them having one, which I suppose is good for them in that they weren't going to succeed on it anyways.
Their second unit, you know, or third, depends on the rotation, but Tom Pyatt and Killorn are part of their second unit, and then they have Brewer and Keith Ollie.
Is there any a significant drop down from when? I mean, I know they're 17th over in the league, so it's not like they're that good to start with, but.
Not really. They're a little bit different. I mean, Hedman and Carl are superior to Brewer and Ollie, in my opinion.
I like that Keith Ollie. He's a good player.
Not bad, but, you know, I think with Carl and Hedman, not that Brewer doesn't fit the description as well, big guys who can skate pretty well, long sticks, can take away a lot of room. So if your defensemen are going to be aggressive and they can skate, it's part and parcel with the system they play. Guy Boucher's creative mind, obviously the 1-3-1 on Tampa's power play, which we broke down a number of weeks ago, has been fairly well documented around the league. But the penalty killing is not a system that would work with a unit, with a group that didn't skate very well. And so if he had a defense that just wasn't very mobile, maybe like LA is kind of having trouble with the mobility on the back end a little bit, they'd have trouble with this system. With Tampa, and Brewer's a good skater for a big guy too, you're allowing your players to work towards their strengths, and you're pressuring the other team to make quick decisions. Can the Jets do that tomorrow, to me, is a huge question.
Well, it's funny, Richie. We know that without Tobias Enstrom, the Jets' power play has gone absolutely into the tank. They can't score. And I think you'd agree here. You've got Steven Stamkos and Marty St. Louis as the third pairing forwards.
Yep.
I wouldn't be surprised to see Guy Boucher maybe elevate those guys to even the first group or second group, knowing that you've got Olli Jokinen and Dustin Byfuglien back there, not the fastest guys. So maybe you'll see Stamkos and St. Louis out there on the penalty kill, knowing that they don't have Enstrom, they can be a little bit more aggressive. But I think, you know, the Jets, it's funny, we're talking more about the Tampa penalty kill, but the Jets got to start putting the puck in the net, because it's almost getting to the point when the power play is actually something that you don't want to go on.
That's unfortunately the sad truth, as it's been for the Jets as of late. We'll play Stompin' Tom. We'll let him take us to break for the rest of the show. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. When we come back, we'll discuss Mark Stahl and his eye injury. The Jets are going to face Tampa Bay tomorrow, obviously, where they play?
Tampa Bay.
I'm pretty sure I start talking about, you know, Jewish delicacy.
If it wasn't for my friends making fun of me, who else would make fun of me besides the general public?
You know, Drew, what they call that in the radio business, because, you know,
yeah,
I'm a veteran of the radio business. That's radio gold right there.
Is that what that is?
That was good stuff.
Okay. Is that a blooper?
Yeah.
Put it on the blooper reel.
We have a blooper wheel?
We do now.
Okay. Each week was just its own.
Yeah, every two-hour episode of the show is its own blooper wheel. Anyways, welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Coming up in about 15 minutes' time from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Jeremy Rutherford is going to join us. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, if your careers could be ended with a simple shot to the face and there was a simple device that could prevent that from happening, why wouldn't you wear that device?
What device would that be, Drew?
That would be a shield or a visor. They both work under the same concept in that they prevent flying rubber pucks from almost taking your eye out. Seems pretty straightforward, seems pretty simple. Give me some sort of justification for why players put their careers in jeopardy each and every night.
We know.
Obviously, I'm talking about what happened with Mark Stahl last night in the New York Rangers.
What happened with Mark Stahl last night was obviously very scary. We've seen incidences like what happened with Steve Yzerman, Brian Berard, Manny Malhotra, Chris Pronger. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. Guys that have suffered serious injuries. Some guys are legally blind now. Guys have had to take significant time off from hockey. And we know now that, you know, just over half the players in the NHL wear visors. I think it's somewhere around 60-65%. But I don't want to say it's getting to the point where the NHL is going to have to act, but I think it's almost a matter of time before the NHL makes visors mandatory. And players in the NHL, you know, they're finicky about what they wear, and a lot of guys don't want to wear visors. But I think if you asked Manny Malhotra what he would rather have, you know, his eyesight or, you know, having the freedom to play without a visor, I'd imagine he'd probably want his full eyesight back. And, you know, we know that college hockey visors are mandatory and minor hockey visors are mandatory. You know, and I think it's just a matter of time before it's going to happen in the NHL. You know, that's the way I view it. You know, if Mark Stahl's wearing a visor, you know, we're not talking about it because he's protected. So I at least, at the very least, support, you know, Bill, the NHL, trying to make it mandatory. But as we know, Richie, the players have to decide themselves if they want them to be mandatory. If the players don't sign up for it, nothing's going to happen. We're going to be talking about this a year from now and 2 years from now.
They fight drug testing. Donald Fehr is going to fight drug testing. He's going to fight anything that takes away the rights of the players to make a decision. And, you know, I'm kind of sick of the visor talk. These players all know the risks. We are, it's transparent. And you know what? So if they know the risks and they opt to take off the visors and they put themselves at risk and they get hurt, well, then so be it. I don't hope for them to get hurt, but they get hurt. Do I think it needs to be mandatory? You know what? I don't, because these players know the risks. They come in, they have all worn cages or visors when they were drafted. So to me, why would you take it off? I mean, I don't know. But if they do, they know the risks involved in taking it off. They see the other players and what's happened. And if they make that decision, fine.
Let me ask you this question, and it's quite possible you don't know the answer to it. Every hockey game takes place in a jurisdiction that has workplace health and safety regulations. Why doesn't a workplace health and safety code ever come into play in all sporting events? You know, why is it okay? You know, you can't work in, you know, in a manufacturing job without proper eyewear when there's a potential for risk. So why is it okay in hockey or in professional sports rather than in every day-to-day jobs?
I'm assuming those unions have collectively bargained for certain protective mechanisms within the system.
Well, I don't even think it has anything to do with a union bargaining. I think that the law of the land saying if you want to do job X, you will need to use the following safety precautions because there's been too many workplace accidents.
Maybe.
You can't just do, you know, you can't operate a factory with no regard to safety rules just because it hasn't been collectively bargained.
Well, I mean, but then you get sued.
Right. So, I mean,
it's been collectively bargained. You're not going to get sued. They know the risk and they're taking it on.
It seems to me that, I mean, I
agree. Think about it, Drew. Think about it. You're Mark Stahl.
Yeah.
You've had concussion problems.
Yep.
You know the risks of playing in the league. And I don't believe actually
he's
of all
been playing hockey since he was 4 years old.
I don't believe any of this stuff. I'm just going off my memory. I don't believe any of the Stahl brothers wear visors.
Jordan and Eric definitely don't. Chip Alexander tweeted as such earlier in the day.
There's a fourth one, Jared Stahl. I'm not sure, but the three in the NHL definitely don't.
And so you know that concussions are a huge risk. You know that a puck. You've seen Manny Malhotra. You play in the National Hockey League.
Yep.
It's happened to different players. I believe it was, you know, Ryan Smith's brother, I believe, lost it. His career ended or was shortened based on an eye injury. And Ryan Smith doesn't wear a visor. I mean, think about that. So these guys all know the risks. And I just don't think I can't worry more about these guys, the players, and their risk involved in what they're doing than they do themselves. So you know the facts. You want to make a decision. Go ahead. If you make the bed, go lie in it. Doesn't mean I'm not going to feel sympathy if, God forbid, anything happens. But, you know, if you think about it, I was talking about it with the station manager before we got on air. The shot that Mark Stahl took, I believe it was Kimmo Tiiminen who took the shot, about 10 feet wide.
It was tipped to two, I believe.
Maybe it was deflected. It was deflected. Okay. But it hit. It wasn't one of those pucks that came up from a tip up under. And what a visor may not have done anything. This was in line, right, with what a visor would have protected him. And he knew when he didn't put a visor on, that's a possibility. You're playing in the National Hockey League. Shots are 110 miles an hour, 107 miles an hour sometimes from Chara and Bufflin and those guys. That's part of the deal. And you can protect yourself or you can decide not to.
I don't have a problem with that.
Couldn't you use the analogy? I mean, there was a time when doctors were promoting smoking, and smoking, you know, wasn't taxed like it is now. There was a time when seatbelts, pardon me, weren't mandatory in cars. Now, what happens when you wear a seatbelt? Don't wear a seatbelt, you get fined. I mean, how is this any different?
Remus, you have some insight into that.
About seatbelts?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want to get. I got into it the other day.
Well, I thought you were about to correct me. I
was just throwing Remus under the bus for.
Look, if you don't wear a seatbelt, you know the risks, and you're an idiot, and you're liable to get ticketed.
Absolutely.
Speaking from personal experience.
I mean, again, no. I feel it is important that we talk about this. There we go. There's the bus sound that Reem loves to play.
You know. Can we transition? We don't understand why the visors. In the Toronto-Ottawa game, which is taking place right now on TSN, 26 seconds into this game was a fight between Fraser McLaren and David Jerzynski of the Ottawa Senators. McLaren knocked Jerzynski out cold onto the ice. He hasn't returned to the game. He's got a concussion. He obviously won't return to the game. Can you make the same argument for fighting as you can for... You know, as you can for visors, if the NHL, that it's not the NHL's responsibility to step in and eliminate it, if the players still want to participate in fights or without visors or everything else.
You can make the argument.
It
goes both ways.
If you haven't yet seen the video, we'll tweet it out on our Twitter page, @IllegalCurve. It's McLaren knocks the guy out. He's unconscious, face down on the ice, 26 seconds into the game.
The intention of every fight is to knock the guy out.
Rarely so when happens.
When it happens once in a while, you know, hey, I'm shocked. Guy gets concussion when he gets into a fight. I mean, when you get into a fight at the bar, if you're stupid enough to get in a fight at the bar, you get punched out. You might get a concussion. It's a fight.
Richie, we've had this debate on the show before, and I believe we took each side of the debate about fighting in hockey. And this is something different. Most guys don't fight. That doesn't make it okay. But my main argument, and you guys remember that when we did that a couple years back and had that whole show on fighting, really. Fighting is, whether you like it or not, you have to give me this, that it is a part of the game, and it actually has a strategic purpose in the game. What's that purpose? You get into a fight, you wake your team up.
What's the strategic purpose 26 seconds into the game to fight?
Well, there are fights that are staged and they aren't, but I'm just saying that fighting can be, give me that much, can be for a purpose. That's a fact. That's a fact. Ask any hockey person that, and they'll agree that that's a fact. Whether you like it or not. And sure,
you're right, because yesterday, had Chris Thorburn been in the Jets lineup yesterday,
they would have won.
No, they wouldn't have won necessarily. But had he been in the Jets lineup yesterday, and through 10 minutes of that game, he had seen how his team had played. Sluggish, disinterested.
He might have
apathetic.
Picked a fight with his own team.
He probably would have dropped the gloves with George Parros. I think he would have to try and, I don't know if it would have worked, but he would have tried to at least give his team a bit of a boost. I think it's completely backwards that's the logic, that his teammates need him to fight in order to get a boost. But so be it, that's the mentality in the NHL still to this day. But without Chris Thorburn being in that lineup last night, there was nobody on the Jets who was willing to drop the gloves and engage in that action.
Right. And Drew, the whole, I know we got to go to break soon, but I mean, the whole point we're trying to make here is trying to make the game safer. I mean, that's what we're trying to do. Yeah, fighting would make the game safer, but, you know, just like visors, you ask the majority of these guys at many levels of hockey, they'll say, no, we want to keep fighting. You ask fans, I'm sorry, you do a poll, I know people are behind me on this. Do a poll of the 15,003 people that were at the last Jets game. Ask them if they want to keep fighting in the game. I guarantee the answer will be yes.
You know, if they want to fight, again, if they want to fight, you give me the whole culture argument, but if you want to fight and you have the option of doing so, go ahead. I'm not reacting every single time somebody gets knocked out or somebody loses an eye, whatever it may be, overreacting to it. These guys know the risk before that. It's not like somebody hasn't lost an eye before. It's unfortunate. It's not like somebody hasn't gotten knocked out before. I mean, we all watch Ty Domi, Sean Cronin, and all those boys. So nothing's changed. It's just that now everybody needs to have an opinion and a say on everything and react, just have this crazy reaction to everything that goes on an hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute basis. I'm not falling prey to that.
Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. When we come back, Jeremy Rutherford of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is going to join us. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus is on loan to us from Rick Ralph and the TSN 1290 Roundtable. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is IllegalCurve.com.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
We welcome to NHL Midweek our good friend from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Jeremy Rutherford. Jeremy, good evening, and how is the weather in Phoenix, Arizona?
It's terrific here. Well, I'm just taking a stab here, maybe 60 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's better than what I'm used to back in St. Louis.
Yes, and I can assure you that's also better than what we're currently going through in Winnipeg. But
I can guess.
Yeah, it's almost time for spring, any day now. Jeremy, you know, when you looked at the St. Louis Blues at the start of this season, they were sort of a lot of people's pick to come out of the Western Conference, or at least to be up there, challenge for the Central Division title in the Western Conference. Now, obviously, the Chicago Blackhawks have really put that story to bed already with their incredible start to the season. But is there any sort of apprehension in St. Louis over the slow start that the Blues have had to this year?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And, you know, this play right now, their performance right now, comes after a 6-1 start. So I think when you have those expectations to be a, I don't know about a cup contender, but a strong playoff contender built up, and then you get off to the 6-1 start, I think in St. Louis everybody thought, wow, this could be the year. And then things just hit the skids. And, you know, to cut to the chase, it's been the goaltending has been a huge issue last year. I think everybody was surprised by the Blues being tops in the league with Yaroslav Halak and Brian Elliott. They won the Jennings Trophy, and I think people in St. Louis are surprised this year by how far they've dropped off. They have a 870 save percentage. That's after a 929 last year. So they went from first to 24th. It's been an issue all season long. There are other problems. You know, they struggle defensively and might not get the scoring that they were hoping for, but the goaltending, I think, is the root of the problems, and they're really struggling right now.
Jeremy, you're talking about the goaltending, and you wrote about this in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. The Blues have recalled Jake Allen from Peoria, and he actually put together a nice little string of road wins for the Blues. Is it possible that they decide to give him a chance as early as tomorrow night, and if he gets the job done, he could potentially be the number one goaltender until someone else proves that they deserve it?
Yeah, it's his job right now. He flew in from Cleveland, where his Peoria team was playing last night. He flew into Phoenix today. He will get the start tomorrow against the Coyotes, and I think it's going to be much like last time. You know, last time when he was here, Yaroslav Halak had a groin injury, and they were really keeping Brian Elliott away from the ice and just allowing him to hit the reset button. But with Jake Allen, he came in, and he went 3-1 in his first four NHL starts at 906 save percentage, and just really played well and gave this team a lift. And they won three straight on the road, and then they lost his final game. And when that happened, Yaro was ready to come back from injury, so they sent Jake back to Peoria. But now with what happened last night in Los Angeles, I'm sure you guys caught a glimpse of that. Blues up 4-1. They lose 6-4. They can't go on any further with this goaltending the way it's been, and so therefore we'll see Jake Allen in net tomorrow night.
Jeremy, when you watch the Blues, are they, in your opinion, are they deep enough on the back end, or do they need to add another top four defender and maybe complement Kevin Shattenkirk or Pietrangelo? It would probably be Shattenkirk based on the pairings, in order to be able to match up against the opposing team's top two lines on a night-in, night-out basis?
Yeah, they're definitely not deep enough, and they knew that last summer. They tried to upgrade and get a top four guy, preferably a left-handed guy. They're really set on the right side. They've got Pietrangelo, they've got Kevin Shattenkirk on that right side, and they've got Roman Polak, who they like. And it's the left side where the concern is. They have a guy, Ian Cole, has about 60, 70 games in the NHL, and then they have Chris Russell, who's had his moments. And then they have Barrett Jackman. So, you know, that was part of the reason they brought Wade Redden in, take a chance on him, see what he could do. But no, they do not have the defensive depth. They don't have the strength on the left side to contend right now. They're continuing to shop and look for help, but it just hasn't materialized yet.
You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Jeremy Rutherford of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Jeremy, the Blues are down two regulars in Andy McDonald and Alex Steen. Alex Steen was off to a really solid start this year with 16 points in 18 games played. He had injury troubles last year. Is there any fear that, you know, this is another sort of setback in his development? How significant is this injury to the Blues?
Well, it's a big injury because he's a leader. He's a veteran. He's a guy that calms this team down. He's a good voice in the locker room. And he was, as you mentioned, 16 points in 18 games. He was their leading scorer. He was also helping along Vladimir Tarasenko, the Russian rookie, and doing a good job of helping Vladimir along. So you mentioned Andy McDonald goes down with the knee. Alex Steen goes down with the shoulder. That happened in the same practice, just a couple minutes apart, in fact. Those two went down. And then Tarasenko's been out with a concussion. So we talked about the Blues' offensive problems. You know, part of that is you're missing almost an entire line. Well, in fact, an entire line, because those guys were together at the beginning of the season and playing really well. So as far as Steen goes, I think they do really miss him. He did not make this five-game road trip. He's back in St. Louis conditioning. I don't know that he'll be back ready to go when the Blues return this weekend. They do need to get him back because he's a valuable part of this Blues hockey team.
Jeremy, today you wrote about one of my favorite players of all time, 2000 Stanley Cup game-winning goal scorer Jason Arnott, who's on a one-week tryout with the St. Louis Blues right now. And because of the injuries that you mentioned, Andy McDonald, Alexander Steen, also Vladimir Tarasenko, he's an option. Is it possible that he plays tomorrow night? And is there a chance that he's going to stick with them a little bit? What's the latest with Jason Arnott?
Well, I think that he probably does have a spot on this team eventually, but the team says they're not going to decide or, you know, reach a contract agreement if that's the way they're going to go until this weekend. I think Sunday would probably be the earliest they'd, you know, decide whether they're going to sign him or not. It is a one-week tryout. He's just been skating with the team. I don't know how much you can show in, you know, these pregame skates because, you know, you're playing every other night. But just talking to Ken Hitchcock and Doug Armstrong, they think that he still has some speed. He can still get around. The question with him is the shoulder and the knee. He had off-season knee surgery. And also, remember Jason Arnott last year in the playoffs for the Blues, last year of his contract, he was scratched in games 3 and 4 of the second round against Los Angeles. Ken Hitchcock felt that he was kind of favoring some injuries and trying to play where he was compensating for those injuries, and so they scratched him. And it wasn't very pretty. Jason Arnott wasn't happy. And, when he left, there was some kind of, you know, bad air. But they cleared that this past week when he came in and started skating with the team. And he thinks it could be a good fit. And the Blues are in such a desperate situation with all these injuries that they're going to have to probably bring him aboard and see if he can help him out.
Jeremy, there's no doubt in around the hockey world, at least, that Ken Hitchcock knows the game X's and O's wise as well as anyone, and he's also known to be a motivator. But that motivating and his motivating tactics, you know, do work both ways. Is there any fear at all that his demands and maybe excessive demands at times are falling on deaf ears with the players?
I don't think so, and I know it's, you know, kind of the easy way out, the easy answer, but I really don't think so, because this is a Ken Hitchcock that's a lot different than he was in Dallas and Philadelphia. He kind of toned things down, and I'm seeing the same things from him, and granted, I'm not behind closed doors, but I'm seeing the same demeanor, although disappointed right now, that I did last year. And, you know, I just think sometimes teams, players get off the hook too easy with the, you know, the cliche, you know, as the message becomes stale or something, because, you know, these guys have to execute. Ken Hitchcock didn't do anything to lose that game last night after the Blues got the 4-1 lead. And, you know, he's really catered to these guys a lot when, you know, he's ready to go out and go through a tough practice the night after a game or 2 days after a game. His leadership group will say, hey, coach, you know, probably be best if we parked it today. And he says, okay, guys, that's good. Let's get a good practice in the next day. And so they really have a pretty good relationship. And to me, if there's any problems with Ken Hitchcock right now, it's just players not wanting to execute the system and play the way he wants to play. I really don't see any of that right now.
Jeremy, we'll let you go on this final question. When they acquired him as part of the Eric Johnson deal, when Eric Johnson went to Colorado and Kevin Shattenkirk and Chris Stewart came back to St. Louis, you know, there certainly were high hopes for Chris Stewart as a member of the Blues. Last year, a very disappointing year. You know, only 30 points, 15 goals, 15 assists in 79 games. I believe he may have been a healthy scratch in the playoffs. If I might be mistaken on that, you can correct me. You know, he signed the 1-year deal this offseason, $3 million salary. You know, is the team surprised that he's been able to bounce back as well as he has this year?
Well, I don't think surprised. I think, you know, his contract was up. He was a restricted guy, but he signed a 1-year, $3 million extension. So this is basically a contract year for him. And he went back to Toronto and trained his tail off. He really came back. You know, it wasn't obviously a regular training camp, but when he got to camp, he looked like a different person, thinned out, toned up a little bit, really put the time in. And one thing last year is he didn't go to the net. Last year, you'd mentioned the 15 goals, 30 points. He didn't go to the net, but this year he is. I mean, he has his nights where he's a little bit inconsistent, but I think for the most part, he's really found his game again, and he's in better shape. Ken Hitchcock said he was a top six forward last year, but in the third period, they couldn't play him because he wasn't in good enough shape, but he's really changed that around. So, you know, I think he's going to, you know, earn a pretty good paycheck, and I think they want to keep him here in St. Louis.
Jeremy Rutherford from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, thanks very much for joining us this evening on NHL Midweek. We won't see you in Winnipeg this year, but if the realignment goes through, we'll be seeing a lot of each other in the next couple of years.
We'll be partners. Yep. Yeah. No, you're right. Look forward to it.
Take care, Jeremy. Thanks very much. Enjoy Phoenix.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. 25 minutes before the top of the hour. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290.
Hump Day.
Wednesday is referred to as that, yes?
Yep.
Isn't every day a weekend in your life, Ezzy?
Every day's a hump day for me. I gotta get over that hump. Doesn't matter what day of the week it is. That's right.
Anyways, you know, we're trying to get a hold of Kyle Kozier, the director of amateur scouting for Veritas Hockey, to talk about some of the New Jersey Devils prospects. Ezzy, you just must be in heaven today with all this Devils talk on this program.
It's the best. I was telling Richie at the last Jets game that New Jersey was in here for. If we get Lou Lamoriello was walking by me, I almost lost it. I get as excited for the general manager as I do for the players.
Yeah, actually, when I was talking to somebody else, they said that when Lou Lamoriello walked by you,
yeah.
He passed out because of the smell.
Separate issue altogether, but you were disappointed. There was no Brodeur.
Well, it's funny. Marty only played here once last year, and I don't think New Jersey comes back into town, if I'm not mistaken. There's one more game in New Jersey.
That's it.
Yeah, that's right.
So he's not going to be here this year, but he said he was going to play next year, so we might see him here next year, but regardless, the best of all time,
yes,
in my opinion.
We know about that. Now, the prospects for the Devils are sort of a mixed bag. You know, you always got to start, when you talk about the prospects for the Devils, you always have to start with the goaltender. Who's going to be the goaltender of the future?
That's a good question. I don't know if Kyle's going to be able to answer that one, because that's the million-dollar question for
Lamoriello. And that's the problem that they haven't yet been able to figure out is, you know, at this point in time, you have to believe that if there was a young guy that could have stepped in and replaced Hedberg as the backup, they would be grooming that guy at this point in time. But they obviously don't have enough confidence yet to, you know, say to Johan, you know, you're 39, you know, we got some, you know, you can become our goaltender coach. We have somebody else that we want to get to some of that game action. We have Kyle on the line. KK, Director of Amateur Scouting, Kyle Kozier. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Hey, very good, guys. How's it going?
Doing very well, thank you very much. We're just talking about the Devils' goaltending situation and their, you know, struggle to find the goaltender of the future. The name that jumps out to most people, at least to Canadian hockey fans, because they remember him from his World Junior days, is Scott Wedgwood. He was drafted in the third round in 2010. You know,
right.
We know it takes goaltenders longer to develop. You know, is Scott Wedgwood still a legitimate option as the goaltender of the future for the Devils?
You know, I think it is. I think there's such a tendency sometimes to write kids off a little early. And again, you mentioned that it does take goaltenders longer. And, you know, he's playing in the ECHL right now with Trenton. And, you know, the numbers there aren't great. And we actually have another kid playing on that team that said he's technically very sound, just sometimes facing a bit of a confidence issue from time to time. So again, it's, you know, there's several goalies that are, you know, in the NHL now that spent quite a bit of time in the ECHL, and you know, Devin Dubnyk is an example. He finally kind of took a starting job at 25th. So, you know, it's not to say that Wedgwood is a lock, you know, to pan out, but it's really very early to write him off, and it's probably a good place for him to learn if he is having some issues. And, you know, it's seeing that, I guess, that double-A pitching instead of rushing him is probably a good idea for the Devils.
KK, I wanted to ask you about a few defensemen. I think you'd agree that a lot of the prospects that we're going to talk about and a lot of the prospects that are high up on the Devils' list are goalies and defensemen.
Yeah.
Alexander Urban is a guy that got a cup of tea with the New Jersey Devils, played, I believe, about a dozen games, and more of a kind of stay-at-home guy, a little bit of offensive talent. He's playing in Albany. How has he progressed this year, and you know, are the Devils maybe going to call him up? Because we know the Devils' D has struggled a little bit. Anton Volchenkov was a healthy scratch in Winnipeg. So what's the latest on Urban?
Well, again, that's, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's sort of a stay-at-home guy. He's big, you know, 6'5", 210, 215, something like that. Has had a couple cups of coffee with the Devils. So of all the prospects, he's probably the most NHL-ready out of that group. And because he's sort of the low advance, you know, chip it off the glass type of guy, doesn't look to do anything too fancy, doesn't look to press. That's the type of guy that can fit into a sort of a tight system like the Devils and not really skip a beat coming up from Albany. So that's probably, again, like you say, a pretty fair bet for a call-up late in the season, especially, just like you say, because, you know, the current Devils defensemen aren't exactly kicking out the jams, as they say. So,
Kyle, John Merrill is a guy that I'm sure you're probably very familiar with. You know, bigger guy,
yeah.
Big defenseman, big left-handed shooting defenseman. The Devils took him in the 2010 entry draft in the second round. He played on the under-18 U.S. team, and then obviously, not obviously, but now he's at the University of Michigan. Can you talk about his game and what the Devils see for him in the future?
Sure. Well, you know, he's really, obviously, as you mentioned, one of the more highly rated Devils defenseman. I first saw him when he was 15 playing for Little Caesars at a tournament in Detroit, and of course he went on to the national development team. Big guy, always had sort of a mature body and a mature game, even as a young guy. I'm not sure if you looked at his numbers recently, but
yeah.
You know, he had just really a knockout freshman season in Michigan. Got in a little bit of trouble second year, was suspended for a long time. Nobody's ever really come out and said what for. There's, you know, a lot of theories, but I mean, it's just speculation. It's sort of a moot point right now, so missed a lot of games then. There was some thought that he'd move on and play in the OHL, but he stuck around. And then this year, hurt his back in an exhibition game. So he's really kind of been limited in terms of development. But, you know, still this senior year coming up, I get no big rush to move him on. So if you can put everything back together, build on that freshman season, you know, at the end of the year now, of course, Michigan season is likely going to be ending here pretty soon. And moving into next year, that's the guy that probably figures to. His development might be slowed a little bit because of those sort of two, you know, washout seasons, I guess, for lack of a better term. But, again, I'm sure they're still very high on him. He has a lot of good tools. Apparently, his suspension, he took that as a real good learning experience and kind of, you know, it refocused the game and refocused the stuff away from the ring, too, and hopefully that served him well going forward.
You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're joined by Kyle Kozier. He's the Director of Amateur Scouting for Veritas Hockey. Kyle, being based in Grand Forks, North Dakota, there's a guy playing for the for UND named Derek Rodwell. He was drafted in the fifth round of the 2009 draft by the Devils. He's a left winger. You know, 27 games played for UND, only 2 points. I assume most of his game is then more so on the you know, the defensive side rather than the offensive side.
Well, that's I guess it is now. You know, coming out of the Alberta Junior League, he was you know, pretty fair scorer. Had a reasonable freshman year at UND. You know, I think he flirted with 10 goals there, if I remember right. But the offense has really dropped off for him lately, and now he sort of finds himself resigned to a third or fourth line role. Sometimes even out of the lineup, just seemingly lost that offensive touch. But again, a big body, so if he commits to being, you know, more defensive player or sort of an agitator or a grinder, you know, there's certainly room for him to grow. But sometimes, I think we talked about maybe a couple of weeks ago that it's hard for guys to adjust to, you know, going from being a scorer to being playing a different role on the team too. So I think that'll really factor it, into his game in a big way here to see how he kind of takes that change of role you know, in a mental sense.
KK, sticking with defensemen and American college hockey, Seth Helgeson was also drafted in that 2009 draft year, and he plays out of the University of Minnesota. He's in his fourth year. Some people have compared him to Colin White, actually, a guy that I love and was very successful for the Devils for many years.
He had an eye injury too, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, actually. Yeah. What do you like about his game, and is there a chance the Devils might give him a chance after he's done in college?
Well, that's, again, when you talk about a guy that might be a good fit for the Devils, you know, Ellington was really, really very highly rated in his draft. You're playing in the USHL. He's one of those kids that grew to be, you know, 6'4", 6'5", as a teenager, and of course, as a defenseman, people start salivating over him. As some of his peers start to catch up, his game has sort of evolved where he wasn't as highly thought of as he once was. But again, you know, 6'5", I think 220, plays a pretty mean game. And again, just like Urquhart, it's a guy that, you know, when you play that sort of tight defensive system that the New Jersey still does, you can plug that guy in because he's low event. He, again, not doesn't do anything flashy, hits care of his own end. You know, maybe not the most fleet of foot, but, you know, some of the system aspects of the game can kind of hide that. So I would still think you need some time in the American League to kind of get things figured out a little bit. Plays on a very strong Minnesota team, and again, you sometimes got glotting over some of the flaws too. So we'll see where, you know, how he handles it as a pro. But again, just like you say, size is one of the things you can't teach. So he can turn himself into a Colin White, and the Devils might still have a pretty useful tender there.
Kyle, you know, last week the Devils were in town and we saw their 2012. You know, we've talked about 2009, 2010, but their 2012 first-round pick was already in the lineup when we saw them last in Stephane Matteau. You've seen him play at the USHL level. Excuse me, he's played actually with in your home province for the Notre Dame Hounds in 2009, 2010. So a number of connections there. What do you think of his game? I mean, he looked like he could really move around for a bigger a guy who's built quite well. What do you see for him in terms of, you know, his ceiling a couple of years, you know, 5 years down the road?
You know, I mean, I guess I'm kind of reaching back a little bit here, but, you know, you kind of think of a guy like Wendell Clark, who plays a pretty robust style of game, likes to throw his body around. The thing I like the best about him is always seems he looks, when you see him, it looks like he just loves to play. You know, no matter what he's doing, he does everything at full speed. He does have an offensive touch like Clark did too, so you can not only play that robust style of game, but can chip in with goals and that kind of thing too, which is obviously a good thing for the Devils to have to replace some of that scoring in Tweezy. But again, one of those guys that when you watch him play, you can't help but like him just because he just has such a, you see the joy in his face when he's playing. So I really, really hope things turn out for him. And it's kind of nice to see that in fast track in the NHL, that dude, I really think he could be a difference maker for the Devils.
Kyle Kozier, Director of Amateur Scouting for Veritas Hockey, thank you as always for joining us on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Anytime, guys. I always enjoy it.
Take care, KK.
Thanks a lot, KK.
Thanks.
Let's go to break. Bye. You're listening to TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus is here as well. One final segment for this Wednesday night. It's called Over Under.
Over Under.
The gin blossoms.
Hey, Jealousy.
Yeah, this fall you down.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. They also do Hey Jealousy, though, right?
Also a good song, yes.
Okay. I just want to whip out my cut-off jean shorts and my Nirvana T-shirt and just
listen to
Soundgarden on cassette tape.
Through one half of this season, the Buffalo Sabres are last in the NHL with a power play efficiency percentage of 11.5%.
Unbelievable.
Having scored 10 goals in 87 power play opportunities. Their 87 power play opportunities rank 14th overall in the NHL. The Buffalo Sabres will finish with over or under 25 power play goals this season.
Remus?
Yeah.
How long is this question here?
It's pretty long-winded.
All my questions are long-winded. Rather that than listen to you mumble through your answers.
It's going to be, Drew, I think it'll be over.
You think it's over 25 power play goals?
Yes, I do. I just don't think you're going to keep out an efficient. You're going to. This is the point. The Sabres aren't going to be performing at an 11.5 clip for the remainder of the season. They have too much talent. Now, you may question whether they have the defense, and you talk about the defense later in the segment, but offensively, you know, they have some good offensive, well, Ehrhoff specifically, and Sakara can move the puck a bit, and Myers when he's playing all right. But their offense, their forwards, they still have some top-end talent. I see them being higher than 25 power play goals in the season.
I agree with Richie. Over Ville, Lino's going to help. He's coming back. But, you know, guys will just eventually start going. Tyler Ennis has played pretty well. Vanek is really the only guy that's put up big numbers, and he's still top five in the league in scoring. It's got to be over. And, again, I picked the Sabres to make the playoffs. It still boggles my mind how bad they've been.
Yeah.
I still wouldn't be surprised if they go on a mid-season run here.
Over under.
Ryan Miller has played in 22 games so far this season for the Buffalo Sabres. In those 22 games, he has faced an NHL-leading 723 shots against, 144 more shots than the second-place goaltender. That's an average of 32.9 shots against per game. At the end of the year, Ryan Miller will have faced over or under an average of 31.5 shots against per game.
Over, Drew, because I think, you know, to get under that, you really have to cut your shots down by, what, about three a game. And I just don't see, that's a significant, you know, people say, oh, just three. But three every single game, I don't see that happening. The team, and you also have to take into account a new coach, adjustments there, just a lack of overall talent on the back end. I don't see it.
I'm going to say over as well. I mean, and you think about that stat, and one of the reasons why the Buffalo Sabres are in last place, no secondary scoring, and their defense hasn't performed. And, you know, Tyler Myers, Richie mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, and I agreed with him. You know, Tyler Myers is the key to that defense, and he got the contract after he had the good rookie year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I like Robin Regier, and, you know, I think Christian Ehrhoff is not very good defensively. He's more of a guy that you want to put on the power play. But just way too many shots that they give up. And, you know, Ryan Miller's still one of the best goalies in the league, but he can't do it all himself. And, you know, the Sabres have too many forwards that aren't performing as well. They're really a one-line hockey team, guys. And, you know, so I'm going to say over. And, you know, if they don't improve it, then really they're not going to get better results.
Over under.
Sabres defenseman Christian Ehrhoff is currently sixth on the team in points, with 10 points in 23 games played. No other Sabres defenseman has even managed 5 points through the first half of this season. Removing Ehrhoff from consideration, over or under 0.5 Sabres defensemen reaching 10 points this season?
Over. I think one has to get that to that total. First of all, what if Ehrhoff gets injured? Somebody gets all that ice time. That's a possibility as well. Then the other guys on the back end, some of them can move the puck. You know, we mentioned Sakara. I'm not sure what his health status is now. We talk about Tyler Myers. We talk about Leopold. I mean, these guys certainly have their defensive drawbacks, but they can all move the puck. And so some of those assists that they'll get as a second assist on a long pass or whatever it may be, I think somebody will eclipse that half, and at least one defenseman will have 10 points.
I think it'll be two. I think it'll be Myers and Leopold once he gets back into his regular form. I really think the Buffalo Sabres, even though they're in last place, I don't think they're out of it. You know, I'm going to go on a bit of a bold prediction. I'm sticking by my prediction that they'd make the playoffs, and I still think they're going to make the playoffs. I think they've just been off to a horrible start.
It's a good thing for you. We never actually keep track of any of our bold predictions.
Remus, by the way, you should be keeping track of all these.
Yeah, I should start doing that.
Like, instead of, you know, checking.
I should start doing that, but there's no way I'm actually going to do it.
You put a spreadsheet, and we go over it, you know, like we did with our Jets predictions. I know you're scoping things out during the segments here, but it wouldn't hurt to put an Excel spreadsheet.
Fair enough.
Reem is
absolutely.
Reem, you're just actually going through your mail like Joffrey Lupul was today. I saw that tweet. Reem gets fan mail. He's just going through it.
Do we have a commitment from you there?
Yes, I will keep track of these weekly.
Starting
next week.
Okay.
Over under.
Never.
So far this year, Christian Ehrhoff is leading the Sabres with an average of 25 minutes and 1 second of ice time per game. The second leading Sabres player in ice time is Jordan Leopold at 21 minutes, 16 seconds of ice time. This is a gap of 3 minutes, 45 seconds of ice time, the biggest gap between first and second place on the Sabres since 2002-2003, when there was a 4 minute, 52 second gap between Alexei Zhitnik and Dmitry Kalinin.
Wow.
At the end of the season, the gap between Christian Ehrhoff's average time on ice and the second place finisher will be less than or greater than 3 minutes 30 seconds.
Are we talking about Ehrhoff, or is Drew talking our air off?
Sorry, this is why I don't keep track, because I have no idea what the question was.
Wow, I felt like I wrote the LSAT again.
Well, then it was a pretty straightforward question. I'm saying that the...
And we all know how that turned out, Richie. One of us got into law school, and I think we know which one did.
Right now, the gap between Christian Ehrhoff and Jordan Leopold is 3 minutes and 45 seconds of ice time. They are the Sabres' leading ice time getters through the first half of the season.
Do I need a scientific calculator to calculate this one?
Getter's not a word either.
Did I say getter?
You said ice time getters.
Really? Usually I'm better than that. Anyways, do you guys want to have a prediction of it's going to be over or under?
I think it'll be over.
You think it'll be over 3 minutes and 30 seconds?
I do. Sorry. Under.
Under.
Okay. We're giving you a hard time. You know that we love you. I'm going to say under. That gap's got to, you know, Ehrhoff's playing too much. I by the way, you know, I don't want to pick on Ehrhoff. I'm not a big fan of Ehrhoff, and I didn't like the contract then, and I don't think he's a very good defenseman. I think, you know, once in a while, look who he was playing with. I could get into this about Ehrhoff, but, you know, you're playing on Vancouver with the Sedins and Kessler and everything like that. You look really good, and all of a sudden you go to Buffalo, you get the big contract, and you're depended on to be a top two defenseman. Look how he's doing. Anyways, I don't want to get into it, so.
Keep your eye on.
I'll start with you, genius.
Yeah, Ezzy, go. reading Elliot Friedman's 30 Thoughts, he talks about Marian Gabrick and the possibility that he may be floated out there in the market. I think, and obviously I'm not trying to poke fun at this at all, but based on the eye injury of Staal, trading a guy like Gabrick, or at least considering it, allows you to maybe fill a few holes if Staal's injury really is that significant. Because the Rangers are trying to win now. I know they have some good prospects, but they're trying to win now. And so I would keep my eye on that situation there in New York. Maybe they, you know, they bring in Nash. Maybe they ship a bigger guy out to try and fill some of the holes that may have been created based on the taking on that contract.
Ezzy?
I'm going to say keep an eye on Brian Bickle. I have really started to really like this guy. Chicago just tied it up, and I know there's a lot at stake here. Brian Bickle scored a couple goals the other night and kept the streak alive. He's turning into one of those guys that when Chicago makes the playoffs, he's going to get clutch goals a la Dave Boland, who's had some injury troubles this year. But Brian Bickle's on the third line with Victor Stahlberg and Andrew Shaw, and he's a guy, he's big, and he's in his third full-time year with the Hawks this year, and I think he's becoming a really good complementary player, the type of guy that will do whatever it takes to win. Like a guy like Dave Boland, we all know how good he was in 2010 when the Hawks won the Cup. So Brian Bickle's the guy. Watch him. He's becoming a really good hockey player. He's 24 years old and really like him. He's the type of playoff warrior every team wants to have on their team.
That's it for this Wednesday night and NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to our guests, Nashville Predators General Manager David Poile, Jeremy Rutherford from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Kyle Kozier, Director of Amateur Scouting for Veritas Hockey. Big thank you to our sponsor, Bernstein's Deli. In case you missed any of this program, it will be available for download on iTunes and on the TSN1290.ca website. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website with your latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. Saturday afternoon, 12 noon, the Illegal Curve Hockey Show takes to air here on TSN 1290. 3 hours of Jets talk and whatever else is going on around the NHL. For producer Remus, who's on loan from Rick Ralph in the TSN 1290 roundtable. For Ezra Ginsberg, for Richard Pollock, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. We wish you good night and good luck.
You've been listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve. Join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for your midweek NHL update. And join Drew Mindell, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg Saturdays for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.